It is likely that you appreciate music and film and arts and culture, but do you realize how much you are influenced by them? How much you are influenced by culture? We are going to talk with a guest about how culture has become a powerful political weapon, and we will wonder what you think. I'm Joy Cardine. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Our guest is the author of the book Culture as Weapon: The Art of Influence in Everyday Life, and we will welcome your thoughts and questions for him at 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. Our guest is Nato Thompson, the artistic director at Creative Time, the New York public arts organization, and he is the author of a number of books. His latest is Culture as Weapon. Good morning.
Morning.
Thanks for being with us. Well, we'll get into it as we go along, but what do you mean weapon? Well, why is our culture a weapon?
Well, certainly it's not like a gun per se, so it is a different kind of weapon, but it is something that can be used to get you to do something. So that is to say, one can use culture to deploy it or use it in the world to get someone who's on the receiving end to do something. Certainly our most familiar relationship to that is straight up advertising. You take a Budweiser commercial, you put some beautiful horses, the images of the beer, maybe even a Christmas look to it, and it certainly gives you a feeling that makes you think, I really need to drink a beer. It's pretty simple. But you know, that kind of basic sense that we use images to get people to do something is the underlying premise of the book.
Yeah, and I guess I just was thinking about that Budweiser commercial. So yeah, we can see a Budweiser commercial with snow and horses and such. But we also can see a Budweiser commercial that has a pro-immigration message to it.
Well, yeah. So that was the commercial that was played during the Super Bowl, which, quite frankly, got Budweiser in some hot water because it is a certain immigration tale. Funny enough, I actually did some background research on that, and they produced that ad, you know, about 8 months previous. They've been working on it. It almost looks like a feature film. They put so much money into it. But they did not anticipate the Trump executive order such that the furor over immigration would be such a hot-button issue by the time it aired during Super Bowl time. So it certainly positioned them in a kind of political light. That said, I would say their hope was to kind of have their cake and eat it too, my guess, because, of course, in a polarized political environment that we're in today, the story of the immigrant appeals to the kind of pull yourself up from the bootstraps Christian conservative mentality, but simultaneously they were hoping, I suspect, to appeal to the kind of immigration-sensitive, liberal-leaning types as well. So I think they were trying to, you know, somehow find something that was both edgy as well as appealing to different kinds of the political spectrum, and it might have backfired a bit.
Yeah, well, it's interesting, but when you say culture as weapon, it can be a tool that can influence us positively and negatively.
Well, right, like so, a tool like anything is somewhat ethically neutral. It's just, you know, the ways it's used, I suppose. So the book, you know, in the first two chapters of the book, I really go into the kind of history of and the growth of PR and marketing. And while we're certainly awash in it today, it is useful to remember that politics, not, you know, certainly 100 years ago, was not as comfortable with the kind of spin that we do today. Political ads weren't as big a part of that, but also there was a gentleman named Edward Bernays, who's considered one of the founders of contemporary public relations. He was also the nephew of Sigmund Freud. And he developed, among many things, actually, the first political press stunt with Calvin Coolidge. So the idea that one could do something in front of cameras or for newspapers as a sort of stunt. So Calvin Coolidge actually had have a pancake breakfast with celebrities to kind of somehow shake off his staid, not cool image. Certainly something you can imagine a candidate doing today as well. But the idea was he would have pancake breakfast with all these celebrities. But so Edward Bernays was the first to kind of develop this idea that the image of a person is a big kind of showmanship P.T. Barnum thing. And we see that growing and growing as an industry over the last 120 years to the point where PR and marketing are now so not only a part of politics, obviously, and product placement, but even a part of just regular communication today.
Yeah. And just for before we get too far into this, when we're talking about culture, are you primarily talking about political advertising or advertising and not so much the, you know, sculpture in the museum?
Well, I try to make the connection between all of it because we often think, certainly with the capital C culture, we think of our arts and entertainment. So we think of, you know, either a museum with paintings or, if it's more contemporary, maybe a video art piece or a sculpture. But we also may think of opera or dance. And we'd like to categorize those kind of cultural things in a separate category from the more commercial entertainment stuff like TV, radio, film. But I would say, in general, what all of these share is a certain understanding of two things, basically, that one can manipulate symbols and shapes and forms to get someone to feel a certain way. And that basic insight, which is very old, is what I would think is the kind of binding glue or sensibility of the arts. But because we typically think of the arts as quite separate from this other field we are in, we don't appreciate just how omnipresent the arts are, that sensibility of using culture as a way to get us to feel something, how much it's infused in everything we encounter today.
Yeah, we are, even how it's infused into our local coffee shop, or for that matter, the Starbucks coffee shop, you bring that up.
Well, yes, so I have a chapter about the corporate civic, and that chapter really hones in on three stores, which one would have to live on an alien planet at this point to not be familiar with, which is the Apple Store, Starbucks, and IKEA, all three of which gained prominence through the 90s and the last decade, particularly with a simple kind of awareness, which was that not only is culture powerful as an image, but also people gravitate towards spaces where they feel together, or the civic, a sense of the civic. So, interestingly, Starbucks, which used to be run by the guys that now have Pete's Coffee, they were taken over by the head of marketing, who actually went to Italy and saw something that anyone that goes to Italy always sees, which is the espresso bars and people mm-hmm. hanging out with their little cups of espressos at little tables and hanging out and chatting for what seems like all day. He was struck by that because he thought, my God, coffee isn't just a drink. It is a way in which people come together. And that basic insight that coffee was a social phenomena made Starbucks what it is, where they brought in the espresso machines, and they really thought the experience of the coffee shop was what Starbucks would sell, not just a coffee.
Yeah. So what's wrong with Starbucks appealing to us to, you know, come there to buy our lattes?
Well, I try as much as I can to get away from what is wrong just yet, to not try to put too much of a heavy hand of my own ethical feelings on it. But one would certainly have to say that it is an environment where that sociality is there to get you to buy. It's just a simple capitalist logic, and one can think about how they feel about that. But it is useful to know, just on a basic level, that just like advertising, sociality in this case, just in a profoundly more rich sense of what an ad is a bigger sense of what an advertisement can be. And I think it's useful for us as people to understand that we are, to some degree, it is not neutral, right? The Starbucks base, the sociality, is not neutral. It has an agenda. You can, I think for all of us, I don't want to, I have my own ideas of what it means to enter a space that has an ulterior motive. But one should at least know that and also be aware that one is being, to some degree, manipulated by that. And if you're okay with that, that's fine, but you should be aware of that.
You
and
don't think that... I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt, but you don't think that most of us are aware of how we are being influenced by culture?
No, I think, you know, and it's two parts I'll say to that. One is, no, I do not think we are. I think we often, especially in the United States, but around the world, I mean, people like to think that they are in charge of every decision they make. It's useful to think of oneself that way, and that you can read through a Budweiser ad, and you can read through all the commercials, and of course Starbucks isn't manipulating you. But I would like to say that if that stuff didn't work, they wouldn't spend so much money on it. So it seems to work, this stuff that people are doing that uses culture. And we, as people, need to also understand, sometimes you can't outthink what you feel. You know, for example, in the logic of advertising, they understand that you can't outthink impressions. Like, your brain will make connections between things, whether or not you think you're smarter than them. Your brain is very associative and emotive. And so even, and I would say, if the same goes for political advertisements, that we may think we're able to outthink them, but they do brand, they give sense of association. So it's important for us to, I think, appreciate, in a world that's deeply coercive with culture, how vulnerable we are, and to somehow think about us, rather than thinking of us as super smart, rational people. And I'm not just talking about education. I don't think education can get you through it. Like, we have to appreciate, as a society, how vulnerable we are to these powers.
We are talking with Nato Thompson. He is the author of Culture as Weapon, The Art of Influence in Everyday Life. And we're talking about how culture is a tool that can certainly influence us, maybe manipulate us. Wondering if you have any thoughts or questions or examples of this. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. This is the Ideas Network. So how do you think art and culture influences your life? We are talking with the author of Culture as a Weapon, The Art of Influence in Everyday Life. Nato Thompson is the artistic director at Creative Time, which is the New York Public Arts Organization. And we will welcome your thoughts and questions for him about how we are influenced by culture. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. John from Spring Valley has this question. He says, in Wisconsin, they have eliminated the Arts Board and individual arts grants for artists in Wisconsin. I'm an artist, and while there is a lot of lip service to the support of culture in Wisconsin, there's no political or financial support. A contrast is Minnesota, where there are funds and support. I'm wondering if your guest can address the effect public money has on the arts and culture. Also, with on the federal level, the buzz that they may eliminate the National Endowment of the Arts. What are your thoughts on this, Nato?
I think it's quite simple, which is, when we as a society want to reduce everything to dollars and cents, we've clearly lost a profound world of imagination. I think a smart society allows things to be done that allow us to think about a rich, complex world without knowing what it actually does. I say that because that's the great dream of education itself, not just in terms of getting people to know skills, but also to think about the world we are in, to appreciate that knowledge is good in and of itself. And I think that same appreciation can be said for the arts. And a support for the arts is a support of our own capacity as a society to dream together. And that is something that we need to support just like infrastructure. There's roads, there's energy, there's lights on the street, maybe even bike paths. But we also need to support the infrastructure, which is our imagination, and that is the arts. And I strongly support the federal and national and local support of the arts, because if we don't, we just demonstrate our impoverishment of the human imagination.
Well, I know that you've spent a lot of your career investigating the relationship between culture and power. How do culture and power intersect?
Well, it's interesting, you know. Culture is a very powerful tool because we often are actually, when we think of who people really are, we are intimate, fearful at times, loving creatures that want to do good by each other in groups. And a good way to speak to that is through our feelings. Our feelings, not just argumentation and objectivity, but the way we feel about the world. And that domain is culture, and that is the arts. And so I would say, though, that because that actually, that language of how we feel is so powerful, in so much as it really speaks to who we are, it also becomes a tool set that makes, how would I say it? It is something that would be useful for anyone in power to mobilize. And we've seen that I don't want to say just by politicians, but like we were earlier talking about. Big businesses use it. Politicians use it. But also we, on a smaller, much smaller level, use it with our Instagrams, with our social networking, the way we communicate. We're often using feeling as a way to produce meaning in the world.
Let's take a call from Susan in Fitchburg. Hi, Susan.
Hi, good morning.
Morning. What's your question? Susan?
Yes, I'm sorry.
Go ahead, you're on the air.
Oh, hi. I just wanted to to say, as I'm listening to your guest, my children and I have been watching documentaries and looking into minimalism and minimalistic living. And I just wanted to comment that I didn't realize how difficult that would be as a concept for us to adopt as a family. And I think I attribute that to the culture that we live in. It's just, we are such consumers, and it's really kind of an uphill battle for me personally to try to apply that in our lives. But I just didn't expect it to be so difficult.
Interesting.
Yeah,
so it's hard to be a minimalist because we have such a consumer-driven culture, NATO?
Oh, my gosh. How could I not sympathize with that? I think we all feel quite overwhelmed and bombarded. You know, the phone has not helped, but, you know, certainly aggravated and exacerbated our sense that things are coming at us all the time. But I do sense, you know, that more people will become interested in a certain kind of way of paring down the information that comes at them. If you look back to the Industrial Revolution in Great Britain, there was the Luddite movement, where there was a real reaction against the growth of industry, that it was taking away the more agrarian lifestyles, and people wanted to get back to the land. I suspect one would see more of that impulse coming around in the 21st century. That said, not an easy thing to do.
Thank you, Susan, for the call. 1-800-642-1234, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. We are talking with NATO Thompson. He is the author of Culture as Weapon, The Art of Influence in Everyday Life. And we are talking about how we are influenced greatly by culture, and how our guest says that it can be a powerful political weapon or tool. And we welcome your thoughts and questions for him. I wanted to talk a little bit about how it became a powerful political weapon, NATO, before we take more calls. And you did talk some, for example, you think that during the Reagan era in particular, we had the culture wars. Talk some about that.
Well, during the culture wars of the 80s, you know, and that's much more capital C culture. That was considered a time when, you know, that was when the NEA was quite under threat. We had the senator from North Carolina, Jesse Helms, who was quite vociferous in his attacks on the National Endowment for the Arts, in particular an artist named Andre Serrano, who famously made a photograph called Piss Christ, which featured a crucifix dipped in urine upside down and caused quite a stir. And he used that as a way to talk about the immoral nature of much of what constituted the arts and that the federal government should not be supporting that. Now, Helms, and then, of course, he got much support from political figures across the Republican spectrum. They positioned it, and it was read, as an attack on culture. But in fact, I would say that this was a mobilization of culture, that it was, you know, a lot of politicians couldn't care less about how these small things artists were doing, and in the scheme of what's actually affecting people's lives, it was tiny. But they realized these little examples could mobilize vast publics, that the power of demeaning that culture could mobilize a much greater percentage of the country. And so, in a way, it was a double game, which was you demean culture by simultaneously mobilizing culture. And that was a sophistication that, in fact, different PR guys throughout history have been quite aware of. And if you even look back to, certainly I think the turning point was the Nixon administration, who in his cabinet, when he came on board, brought most of the heads of Madison Avenue with him, which is to say most of the ad executives came. And it really showed the power and the understanding of what culture meant for politics.
Yeah. And you don't think we have those culture wars today?
Well, it's I think sometimes it's misleading to think that the world is broken up by this, you know, like, for example, I know that it's a popular idea that there's a red state and a blue state world here, and that people cleanly fall into the Republican or Democratic mindset, like we are somehow innately one or the other. But I would say that, in fact, much of what constitutes that is a mobilization of culture on different ends of a spectrum, but that if you really met with people, their issues are much more complex than that kind of easy breakdown. And so I would say the culture war we're really in is, you know, it's not, I would say, as easy as you wanted to say, like the Trump or anti-Trump world, although there is that you could say. But in fact, I would say it's a different sets of forces of power mobilizing our feelings to get us to do things and seeing through that to find commonality with each other so that we can make our lives better across this country, I think is the real task. I mean, we all feel that very innately, and that in some ways means we got to kind of tune off and start talking to each other and stop listening to the powers that be.
Let's go to Barbara in Eau Claire. Hello, Barbara. You're on the air.
Hello. This is incredible, this subject. I want to say that in the early 90s, I went to Albania to see relatives, and I had been there at the overthrow, when the government was overthrown, the worst communism in Eastern Europe. And you saw, it's so emotional for me, before, you still saw the remnants of Enver Hoxha's influence, where you had the art with the workers, the heroic workers in conformity with their arms, you know what I mean, in a certain way. And people saw this to be the strong worker, and I do not mean to knock workers. That's not my point. But things were conformist, and you had this heroicism. Okay, when that ended, I was there, and the painters, the artists, were out like you couldn't believe, painting in modern ways with color. Color was a luxury, and I am very passionate about this because I'm a writer and love color. Color was a luxury. I went to Czechoslovakia later in my life, and I was there in a little village where things were all these different colors, like I had seen in Tirana, by the way, that Ida Rami had the buildings in Albania and the capital painted in orange and yellow and everything. And in Czechoslovakia, I stood there, and there were these colors, and this man said, the guide said, imagine being here before the revolution. Everything was no color. no color in your life. Can you imagine? And I came back to the United States and I thought how Americans take freedom for granted so much that you think seeing something with color is natural. Do you know what I'm saying?
What's your reaction, NATO?
Well, sure, of course. I mean, state-sponsored communism in Albania, in Romania, in Czechoslovakia, I mean, throughout the Eastern Bloc, and was certainly renowned for its social realism, the upholding of the worker, but at the same time, repressive relationships for the everyday person to culture. So, you know, I totally appreciate that. I would say the United States has a very different relationship. I mean, and not to push back, because I'm a big fan of the arts and people expressing themselves, but it is a weird situation in the United States, which is a very almost the inverse relationship to that one, which is here in America, we have a lot of freedom, but you do have the most powerful forces in this country and the world encouraging you to be free. And maybe that's a good thing, but they have an agenda, obviously. So, you know, you have like a Coca-Cola ad where there'll be like a guy who's frustrated with his job, and then they're like, go out there in the world, and he throws his papers up in the air, and then he's like, hey, I'm out of here, I'm free. And then you'll have an advertisement like Mac, you know, the Mac computer, where they'll basically their positioning is they have, I don't know if you remember that ad, but it was like the kind of young, hip kid that was the Mac, and then there was the dweebish guy in the suit, the tweed suit, that was the PC, right? That was the way they kind of made it seem. So you could almost think of the PC as their kind of positioning as the state, or even like communism for that matter, the kind of bureaucratic, boring administrator, whereas Mac is the liberated, free, yahoo! I think the trick, of course, is that big, powerful forces have encouraged us to be free in a certain symbolic way, while simultaneously driving our wages into the ground and cutting any kind of space. So it is a freedom of sorts they're encouraging, but, you know, I think behind the, if you open the hood, there's a certain agenda there as well that's quite economic.
Interesting. Diane from La Crosse emails, I am part of a theater group of actors and directors in La Crosse who are just starting a series of staged play readings. We call ourselves the Alternative Truth Project, and our first event will be on Saturday, Feb 25, at the Pump House Regional Arts Center. We'll get that plug in there. That's okay. We will do a play reading a month for the next several months. It's free and open to the public to bring an additional voice to the rallies, the protests, the town halls, and the marches. Can you address that, NATO? Here we have a theater group that's getting involved in political protest.
Well, I think that's great. I mean, I think an active citizenry using culture is absolutely critical. It's a big part of what makes living fun. And I also think bringing your own kind of personal group creative process to that is not only important, but also has a long historic tradition across many countries. And the arts have always historically been very much involved in trying to, I guess it's because in some ways, and I'm thinking the arts like theater and poetry and painting and that, you know, that kind of arts, if you will, has always had a deep relationship to social movements. I think it's because they're also deeply romantic and kind of utopian in their hearts, if not on the flip side, depressed and cynical. But I think that they, you know, the embrace of a new world, or how to make the world a better place, is certainly a part of that, and it's a great thing to do.
Yeah. What are your thoughts on how... I saw an article, I think, where you were being asked about culture being used as a weapon for good, and that it would, you know, that there would be some sort of way to change society. I guess it probably was from a more progressive standpoint. Do you think that that's where we're headed?
Well, you know, I'm not. I don't know where we're headed. It feels like these are some pretty crazy times. I mean, I can't even predict a week from now, right, quite frankly. But that said, to go to your kind of question around arts, culture for good, yes, of course. I mean, it is, like I'm saying, a tool. One can use it for a variety of things, and quite frankly, my favorite kind of arts, I do public art. And what I like about public art is it doesn't want you to do anything. It's not there to coerce you or manipulate you. it's like a good book. It's for you to take what you can out of it, to think openly, to kind of get us to think about the world, but at the same time, allowing the viewer to enjoy the world they're in, to think about it. So I do think the arts have that capacity. Simultaneously, I do think that because it is a powerful tool, you know, and because people do want to make the world a better place in general, it is something reasonable to use and has a long tradition of doing that, and I advocate for that strongly. Mm-hmm. That said, I also think it's important to remind ourselves that Plato advocated early on that artists should not be a part of the republic. He wanted them kicked out because he felt that artists spoke in metaphor, that they were very abstract, and that it became very difficult to have an objective political discussion with them around. And if we think about, you know, in some ways I'm very appreciative of that, in so much as if you could imagine a political discussion with no spin, with no ads, not on some TV network where they're having to have breaking news and sensationalize or pundits talking about optics, but just a long conversation where one debates the points and isn't trying to get in little, you know, sneaky things or avoid questions, but a real discussion. That would be so mind-blowing as a political kind of process, but it seems very far from where we are today.
This might seem like an odd question, but do you think that the feud that we see or have seen between President Trump and artists, as in, you know, Hollywood movie stars Meryl Streep, how does that play into your theory on culture as weapon?
Well, I mean, listen, my cards on the table. I think Trump is a real disaster. That said, I always think people have a game they're playing often when they have power. And certainly for a lot of musicians and stuff, sometimes I would say they have their own thing to gain from being against Trump. That said, I think there's a lot of things to be against with Trump as well. But people are kind of lining up. And, I mean, there's a lot to be said about that. I do think in general, though, the arts, I mean, this is much more traditionally speaking. The arts are much more urban phenomena. They speak to an urban sensibility. And I'm talking cities and their complexity. And so they typically naturally line up that way. And ideologically, politically, it's not entirely the case, but that tends to be the case. And at the same time, I don't want to simplify things because Trump is certainly, you know, it's. I think the myth would be to say culture is against Trump. Trump mobilizes culture entirely. That is his skill set. You know, he is a media mastermind, and actually, I don't know if he's a mastermind. He's just naturally telegenic. And the fact of the matter is, if you look at it, what's amazing about him, because he is, to say, he is culture, because even before he became president, no matter what television channel you tuned to, a year and a half before the, you know, before he was elected, the cameras were already glued to this man. That's someone that understands culture. Yeah. And I think it's misleading to think of culture on one side and him on the other.
We will talk more about culture and how it influences us and how it can be a tool for change and how it can be a weapon. We are talking with the author of Culture as Weapon, Nato Thompson. 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. When we come back, we probably will talk a little bit about tweeting and computers and that part of our culture. This is the Ideas Network. You're listening to the Ideas Network, and we are talking about culture and how culture from TV and film and art and, for that matter, advertising, how that influences us, and welcoming your questions and thoughts for our guest, who is Nato Thompson. He is the author of Culture as Weapon, The Art of Influence in Everyday Life. And let's take a call next from David in Milwaukee. Hi, David.
Hi, Joy. Boy, great timing for this show. A lot of us are thinking about this. And here's my thoughts, and I don't know how close I am because it's all evolving, but, you know, they've been selling stuff to us for years. You're prettier, you're stronger, you're this, you're that, if you buy their products, right? Then we start thinking, like, well, you're green if you drive a Volvo or if you drive a Prius. And now it's almost like the slave becomes the master, the tail wags the dog, that these huge corporations are finding out that they're beginning to dance to our tune, that as in a consumer culture, as we define ourselves by that which we consume, either physically or artistically or just symbolically, we're looking to purchase things to consume and define ourselves by that which we purchase. And now the corporations are aligning themselves to march to the beat of our drum. I don't know if that makes any sense, but it's just something I think that we're all starting to think about more and more. And I like what the guest is saying here.
Yeah, and I understand where David's going, right, Nate? Do you too, Nato?
I mean, sure. And, you know, you indicated we might get into this, but the nature of media, the landscape of it has shifted dramatically. There is a phenomena out there called cause-related marketing, and it's growing and growing, which is to say that increasingly brands understand that consumers want a brand that has, quote-unquote, a soul, or at least is more in line with their moral compass. And so I don't know if it's the tail wagging the dog, per se, on the causal front. I think at the end of the day, the economics would line up where the money still ends up in the same pockets, just the images are changing. But but just to say, yes, of course, I think that the nature of what a brand constitutes is important. When you talk about, you know, the Prius or the kind of eco branding, I mean, that's huge right now. And if you looked at the Super Bowl ads, there was a lot of brands positioning themselves as either, you know, much more sympathetic to gender equity or environmental causes. I hope you can hear the somewhat cynicism in my voice, only because it's still just an image. I mean, at the end of the day, it has to line up with facts behind the images that they provide for us to consume.
Do you think, though, that anything's shifting right now? Consumers having the power to, well, for example, get Nordstrom's to drop Ivanka Trump's dresses and accessories?
Yeah, I mean, the answer is yes on that front. I think particularly with the Trump situation, you have a very polarized consumer market. That said, of course, I'm sure Nordstrom knows who buys their clothes, and it was a very calculated decision, not just an ethical one, in terms of how they would be positioned in there. And, for example, you also had when people were doing the delete Uber situation,
yeah,
because they thought Uber was in line with Trump, then you had their competitor Lyft donate gobs of money to the ACLU. Well, of course, Lyft's major backer is a Trump supporter, so the ironies abound. But I do think people are jockeying for a certain corporations are jockeying for where to position themselves in this polarized environment, for sure. And at the same time, I'd like to say that when we'll get into this, but with the advent of social networking and the way news media is being circulated among Twitter accounts and Instagram and Snapchat and Facebook, I would say that has radically shifted the landscape of how we communicate and also how brands are articulating who they are, for sure.
Well, we will talk about that in a moment, and I do want to remind listeners, though, that we have an open line if you have a question, or maybe you have an example of how culture is changing or how culture is influencing you. How do you think a culture is portrayed on social media? 1-800-642-1234 or send an email to talk@wpr.org. You can also post on the Joy Cardine Show Facebook page or tweet us at Joy Cardine Show. We had, I wanted to talk next about a caller who, I'm going to find it soon. Oh, here it is. It's an email. Jonathan emailed, how do video games and other multi-platform experiences impact each generation of their times? I feel like as a young person, I have seen the internet change the game.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the interesting thing on a different level about culture is it all seems kind of silly, so we don't think it's powerful. And, you know, for example, when we think of, I'll get to video games for a second, but if you think about the phenomenon of Netflix, where people began to binge watch, quote unquote.
Yeah.
Binge watch. That phraseology is so critical because it becomes this kind of massive consumption of narrative, of stories. And we, as a culture, are very addicted to our storytelling. I just think about, like, tribal societies where one would have a storyteller in a village. Well, in the village that is America, our storyteller can't stop talking. They go 24/7, always telling stories, and no one leaves. We are addicted to our stories, but we don't think of that as actually important in our lives in a kind of profound sense. We just think that's something we consume and it's passive. But it really does shape our sense of what a story is, what, you know, what we are to expect, what relationships are like, what one should live like in their life, what they should expect. It sets up a lot of parameters of expectation. The same goes for video games, and I'm actually an avid video game player. In fact, the funny thing is I heard Will Arnett say something great, because I just had a kid, and he said the worst thing about having kids is they want to play your video games.
You got a while yet, though. Well, congratulations.
I appreciate that. Mm-hmm. But I think it's funny because video games are extremely narrative-driven, and for more or less, they're pretty violent, I would say. I've gotten pretty inured to it. But I've been really aware, too, that a lot of video games come with these incredibly complex story arcs. And one of the things I've noticed, and I've talked about it a bit, was that a lot of the games I play, the protagonist is always betrayed by everyone. They're this kind of person that's alone in the world who, you know, like, for example, that game Call of Duty, you have this guy who the U.S. military betrays, government betrays, even his family betrays, but he goes on and on. It seems to me really to pinpoint two things. One, we sympathize with a character like that because we feel betrayed as people in America, and also that, you know, my book could have been called Just Because You're Paranoid Doesn't Mean They're Not Out to Get You.
Mm-hmm.
But we feel like everyone's out to get us, right? And that's why everyone believes the media is evil to some degree, but it's because we're just paranoid. But simultaneously, it's also convenient for a video game like Call of Duty, the budget to make these things is as big as any major blockbuster film like Jurassic Park. But it also, because that position has no ideological affinity, it would not offend a Trump supporter, it would not offend a Hillary Clinton supporter, it wouldn't offend anyone, because no matter what your identity politically, you still identify as the one betrayed by everyone.
Yeah. Well, why don't we talk a little bit more about how social media is is changing the game too?
Sure. I mean, if you think historically, the power of media is very much influenced by the technologies that arise during the time, and I think making comparisons to the Third Reich at this time could come off as insensitive and crazy. But I do think it is important to remember that the rise of the Third Reich was very much empowered and encouraged and mobilized by the simultaneous advent of the radio.
Yeah.
And Goebbels was a huge, since we're on radio, was a huge user of radio. And if you can imagine pre-radio, suddenly you have a human voice in your house. It entered your house. Well, we are now coming of age in the Web 2.0 growth and ubiquity of social media, and it is dramatically shifting the landscape of political ideology, of how people think of themselves, what they think of their relationships. And it's funny because, I mean, but weird, you know, we all walk around outside and see people just staring at their phones. And we understand it's making walking down the street difficult and driving difficult, but what is harder to grasp is how it's changing how we all think. And that is showing up in its own ways. I would say it's tangible in so many different ways. We as people are becoming very different than we've been.
An example?
Well, an obvious example that you can feel is just look at this last presidential election. And I'm not just talking about Trump. I'm also talking about the rise of Bernie Sanders. And suddenly, for example, you have two candidates who both push on different ends of the spectrum what is considered allowable political speech. Bernie Sanders talks about Scandinavian social democracy as something that we should strive for. This kind of way of speaking, 4 years ago, people would have said, you will not be a serious candidate if you talk like that. That is just out of the political lexicon. It was just, if you even said the word socialism in America, you were gone. But it totally changed the game. No, all of a sudden it was like, what? This is okay. How did that happen? Simultaneously, Trump starts talking about, he demeans POWs. He offends handicapped people. I mean, he's just saying whatever comes to his mind, he says, and it's offensive. And 4 years ago, you would have said, there's no way a candidate could run. But suddenly, it's just mobilized and moving fast. I think what is considered allowable speech or the bandwidth of political discourse has grown exponentially. And it is now affecting us not only politically, but also in the ways that's just politics. That's not even expressing how we have relationships and such like that.
Paul in Plainfield is with us. Hello, Paul.
Yeah, I just want to point out that there's two sides to every issue, and that's I always get one side. I'm listening to you, so I listen to your side, and I don't ever hear a news program with a balanced approach. And you bring up Meryl Streep. Well, why don't you bring up Kid Rock or Ted Nugent, two vocal, and on social media.
I'm glad you brought him up. I mean, we were talking about the conflict, but let's say Kid Rock and Ted Nugent and how their influence NATO.
Did I read correctly that Kid Rock is being encouraged to run for senator?
I don't know. I haven't seen that.
Well, I really wouldn't rule that out because celebrities have had a long track record in American politics. I think it's good to have a discussion between people on different ideological space, especially for radio and news programs. I think that's absolutely critical. I often kind of push back on the idea that we are somehow like as red state, blue state, like I mentioned earlier, but certainly there are those that identify more as directly, like Meryl Streep versus Kid Rock. Have Kid Rock on the show, my God.
Yeah, there we go. We could do that.
It wouldn't be boring.
Yeah, and actually, Naija Ellison, my producer, found that Kid Rock's name has reportedly been thrown out as a potential Republican contender for a Michigan Senate seat. So,
well, there you go.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah, we're almost completely out of time. What's the takeaway you want to leave our listeners?
Well, I think the takeaway of the book is twofold. One is the arts are an extremely powerful force, and I think we should appreciate that. And to go to the listeners that are artists or interested in the arts or art supporters, I think we need to team up and really talk about the power of art in our societies as an infrastructure we should support. That's one. On the flip side, I do think culture, because it's a powerful force, can be used against us to manipulate us and to make us do things that we don't want to, or to at least set the terms of the discussion.
We'll have to leave it there. Thank you very much. NATO Thompson is author of Culture as Weapon. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network.